I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everyone, welcome to part three of the Stompcast. Thank you so much for joining us again. The rain has stopped. It's kind of, okay, it's not a beautiful summer's day, but it will do on the Stompcast. Are you enjoying your stomp?
Yes, it's so nice to get outside, isn't it? And just, you're seeing like the daffodils and like spring is coming.
It's like an optimism almost, isn't it? And it's, that's what I again, just going back to what I said in part one, really, I do love the seasons. I know sometimes, not too often, I do moan when it's absolutely weeing it down on a Stompcast. But then when I come home, I always feel good. It's like when you go for a run in the rain. I always think that running in the rain, when you're doing it, you're like, oh, annoyed. But when you come home, it's the best feeling. Better than even running in the sunshine, because you feel like you've accomplished something, you've pushed through the rain. I don't know.
I'll take your word for it, because I've not run in a very long time.
You're not a runner. No. What do you like to do? Is walking a part of your kind of, is this a part of your kind of self-care? Do you like to get out for a stomp? What do you like to do in terms of movement and things?
That is such a good question. I have a dog, so I walk my dog, but mostly I run around after my toddler.
Something I love about, and I do actually miss about working like in A&E or whether it's other teams, is that the camaraderie stuff, that kind of, you know, roll your sleeves up together and get through. That is definitely a special part of working in the NHS, I think, isn't it?
Yes, and because we're so multidisciplinary as well, it's so nice to have that input from lots of different specialities. But I do feel like, yeah, you're a special breed if you work in maternity and obstetrics.
So I wonder if at the start of this we could share a few kind of myths but also truths about, you know, from, say, the labour ward or maternity. Like, you know, for example, people trying to, you know, go into labour, saying bouncing on the ball and different kind of things. What's true? Like, what are the kind of myths and what are the things that are actually surprisingly true?
I mean, most things are probably myths. And also, like, there has been probably zero studies on the efficacy of whether bouncing on a ball will get you into labour. But things that have got quite good evidence essentially is making your oxytocin high. So oxytocin is the love hormone, but it's also the hormone that physically causes you to have contractions. So if you can raise your levels of oxytocin, then you're in a really good starting place, aren't you? And where can you get oxytocin from? Orgasms.
Yeah. So, being close to your partner or love.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So sex isn't a myth. Sex might help.
Good sex, because if you're,
it's got to be good sex.
Because if you're not having an orgasm, yeah, then you're not getting that oxytocin,
yeah,
rise.
Okay.
So that would be, in
so
theory,
specifically good sex helps.
Good sex.
Yeah.
Or you don't need to have sex to have an orgasm.
Of course
FYI.
Not. Yeah.
Hand expressing. So when you're expressing the milk,
yeah,
you can do that whilst you're pregnant. And that can also, in theory, like raise your oxytocin and can also potentially help you to get ready for labour. As we discussed in the previous part, we don't really know what tips people over the edge into labour. So these are kind of things that in theory we think will work. There's been some small studies that have suggested that eating dates can be quite useful.
Really?
So like the dried fruit.
I've not heard of that one.
Oh,
wow,
yeah.
Okay.
So, some of these small studies have shown that if you eat 6 or 7 dates a day, then it ripens your cervix, so it makes you more favourable and more ready for labour. People have often heard of like sweeps, stretch and sweeps, membrane sweeps. There's really, really mixed evidence for membrane sweeps.
And what do we mean by that, when it's just for people that don't know? What do you mean?
So a sweep would be like a vaginal examination, and the midwife or the doctor would try and find the cervix, and if it's open, pop finger through the cervix, and then do like a sweeping motion, it's like a circular motion, to separate the bag of waters from the,
yeah,
edge of the womb, and that would, in theory, stimulate prostaglandin release, which are hormones that help ripen your cervix and get you ready to go into labour. So there's really mixed evidence, like really mixed. There's no conclusive evidence that those work at all. So, but a lot of people want to give it a try, or some people really don't. So it's kind of a personal thing about things that you might be willing to try to get yourself into labour.
What about things like a spicy curry and these
yes,
kind of things?
Yes, so they're definitely like old wives' tales, like castor oil, definitely would not recommend. So the theory behind those is that your bowel is very close to your uterus, and so if you irritate your
bowel... Right, okay, so it's going to stimulate something.
Yes,
okay.
But I mean, who wants to have an upset stomach going into labour? I think that's an awful way...
Well, I always
way.
Thought it sounded like a risky...
Yes, who wants that? Who wants that for themselves? But I think years and years ago, they, you know, you'd have... when my mum was a midwife, so quite a long time ago...
Oh, that's amazing. Mum was a midwife.
Yeah,
that's
my mum
awesome.
Was a midwife.
That's
when
awesome.
She was a midwife, that's they cool. used to give you an enema when you were admitted.
That doesn't sound like a very nice entry to the thing,
no,
is it?
But also, like, similar thing of, like, irritating your bowel. I mean,
oh, gosh.
Thankfully, that is not a practice
we,
anymore.
We can reassure
but,
people
yes,
they don't have to be welcome to the unit with that. Yeah.
Having an enema. But that sort of thing of, like, irritating the bowel can be...
Oh,
was
God.
Thought to help stimulate the labour, but... Again, that would not be a nice way of getting yourself into labour at all.
Gosh, that's not the kind of start that you want, does it, really? But yeah. Don't you find it, like, crazy, though, that these things, like, gather momentum where, like, they become, like, almost an accepted, almost as if they're fact, but then we look at them and go, oh, hang on, where did this all start from? I don't know if this is right. It's fascinating to see, isn't it?
Well, there's so many, like, old wives' tales, you know, like, people will drink, like, raspberry leaf tea. Again, there's, like, really limited evidence to suggest that that actually works. And it's, you know, supposed to be strengthening your uterine muscles, or people will have acupuncture, or people will try so many things to get themselves into labour, understandably, because by the time you're term, you're very fed up.
So term, that's when term was saying that's when baby's due, basically, isn't it?
Yes,
at
yeah.
term, baby's ready to come. And so people, I guess, at that point, like, right, I want to go into labour. So is there any kind of, I guess there's not a magic fix, but is there any advice you'd give to someone coming to term? They think, oh, I do want to try and, I don't know, speed things a little bit. Or is it just a matter of just, well, sit and wait?
I think it really depends on what you're willing to do. Because, you know, some person might want to do all of those things because they want to feel like they're trying something. And I think the last bit of pregnancy is really a mental kind of journey, because it's that waiting, it's that expectation, it's the unknown. Like, is it going to happen today? So I don't think, you know, doing some raspberry leaf tea and having a sweep and all of those things are necessarily harmful. But just... I think you need to be aware that there's very limited evidence to support those things.
And do you think sometimes stress plays into it? If you're very
yes.
stressed,
well, yeah.
surely stress is not
well,
helpful for
absolutely. Like cortisol, the stress hormone, and oxytocin, they cannot be both high at the same time.
They oppose each other,
yes,
don't
so
they?
Yes, so if you have lots of cortisol, you're not going to go into labour.
It's why feeling love and close to someone helps with stress. It's the
yes,
opposite
yes,
is true.
Yes,
so
yeah.
if you've got a supportive relationship, if you're feelings of love, most people can relate to that when you're in the moment and you're feeling like really loving with someone, you just feel like in love, you'll often find that your stress is very low, isn't it? Because it opposes. And when your stress is really high, that can often distract you from love or from
yeah.
those good feelings, isn't it?
That's why, you know, if you hate eating dates and you hate curries and you couldn't think of anything worse than having sex, none of those things are going to send you into labour then.
It's good news for you that you don't have to worry
about
those things.
You don't have to do them. I think ultimately we don't really know what tips people over in going into labour, and if you can make your peace with that, then it will make that last stretch a lot easier.
It goes back into that thing though, where like medicine is incredible, and I'm always, you know, in awe of like the stuff that we know and we can do. But isn't it incredible? There's so many fundamental things like that we just don't know about, isn't it? If someone says to you like, why does this happen? It's well, like, well, we can think it might be some of these things we don't actually know.
And that's why, as I said that before, like that's kind of why I love being a midwife, because yes, we can surmise or we can suggest things or you can try these things, you know, why don't you try bouncing on your ball? Why don't you try this? But ultimately we've got no idea. And that's what's really special about having a baby, is that it's its own thing that we
yeah.
have no control over.
Yeah, unbelievable. So let's talk a little bit then about, you know, where we are at the moment and where we can get to. I was actually sat, I was going skiing the other week, and I sat in at the airport and I was watching the news, and I could see, you know, one of the big stories is around, you know, providing time off work for baby loss, but also alongside that there was a lot of discussion of where we are in terms of the stats, and that actually there's a lot of problems in the system here at the moment. So what kind of needs to change? And you said everything earlier, so I'm guessing you've got strong feelings on this, but yeah, what can we do to get to a better place? Like, what is the problem right now, and how do we get to that better place?
Oh, if I had the answer to all of those questions, Alex, I think I would not be working in the NHS. I think the whole, and this is probably not just in like maternity, but obviously the whole of the NHS is struggling with funding and things like that. But, you know, we discussed earlier about fertility and like lack of funding in certain areas. We're not empowering people. I think, you know, even things like education in schools, if we take it back all the way to there, like a lot of people think that when you're taught in schools, if you have sex once, then you will get pregnant. And yes, that can happen, but actually for the majority of people,
statistically,
it takes quite a lot more than that. And it's very shocking.
But that doesn't mean don't wear condoms, by the way.
Please still use protection.
Yeah.
If you're not trying to have a baby. But like in just in terms of education, it was then very shocking when I realised that I wouldn't get pregnant, because I was told that if I had sex once, I was going to get pregnant. I went to an all-girls school, so that was very much the message of you have sex once, you'll have a baby. And definitely within like services, so like early pregnancy services, I think are so poor in this country. So you might, you know, experience some bleeding and your only option is to go and sit in A&E because most places you can't.
Well, that's what I saw a huge number of people with early pregnancy, because of course what would happen, you know, say they start a job, they come, you know, they come, you know, a person comes in who is, say pregnant a certain number of weeks that they believe they'd be pregnant, and they've got bleeding or they've got pain, and then we see them there, and often, you know, it is an unsatisfactory process, because we then, you know, do some, you know, basic tests and stuff, but effectively we want to refer them to early pregnancy units,
which is sometimes open Monday to Friday office hours,
and then often it's just how things are. People tend to come in the evening or whatever, and then we've got a difficult situation where it's like, right, do we keep this person in, or do they go home, they come back in the morning, and it just doesn't feel a very satisfactory process, does it, for anyone involved?
And actually there's pretty much no reassurance that you're going to be able to give to that patient at all, is there?
Like, which is not nice for us either, because we want the vast majority of doctors and nurses want to have someone come in and leave feeling better. I mean, that's a fundamental thing we want, but this is a good example of a scenario where it's really unsatisfactory, because I can't make you feel any better.
No.
Really, other than trying to maybe reassure that you're going to be seen or have a plan for you, it's not great, is it?
But also potentially waiting like 48 hours, you know, so if you attended A&E on Saturday morning with bleeding and you're told that actually EPU, early pregnancy unit, is not open until Monday morning, but they're not even going to pick up that referral until, you know, Monday lunchtime because they're doing all their other things, so then you might not get seen until Monday lunchtime, Tuesday, whatever, and in the meantime you've been panicking that your baby's miscarried. You're right. I mean, it's such a nerve-wracking time. And so it's a really tricky position to be in, because, like you said, what reassurance can you give? Almost nothing. And whether they're seen straight away or not, the nature of early pregnancy is not always that reassuring anyway, because it's a waiting game and you have to see what happens and things like that. And support in those services as well, because you might not be seeing your midwife until 8 to 10 weeks. But if you're 6 weeks and you're bleeding, who have you got? You haven't got anyone to support you.
Fine, so you've not got that initial person. All right, now you're my person almost. That you don't you're kind of in between.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, is this down to money? Is it down to the funding? Is that what it is? Like, do we need to have 24/7 early units? Is that the dream? Is that the ideal? What?
I mean, as a patient, you know, I started when I was pregnant with my son Percy. I started bleeding on Christmas Day. And so I took myself to A&E on Boxing Day, and then obviously everything shut, blah, blah, blah. So I would have been like, yes, I want to be seen right now, because when you're feeling anxious about it, you want to be seen straight away. You know, in terms of service provision, we know that there's chronic lack of funding, so how are we actually going to, where's the money going to come from for that service? So it's such a difficult position to be in, because I can see it from both sides. You know, when I was pregnant, you want to be seen straight away, but as like a service provider, how do you make that work? And that's like the tip of the iceberg as well. Like, even if we walked through like maternity services, you know, a few years ago there's like a big push for continuity, so seeing the same midwife for every appointment. Actually now in practice I'm noticing like a step away from that, because it's, if you're already working in a unit that's very understaffed, you can't sustain that sort of practice. And we know that continuity, so seeing that same midwife throughout your pregnancy and for your labour and birth, has much better outcomes for women, but we can't actually make that model work in practice because we haven't got enough midwives on the ground.
It's kind of like in general practice as well. Like, we know that if someone has the same general practitioner, the relationship they form, but also the understanding that that GP will have with that patient, they know that person, is much better for that patient's journey in life, they kind of care journey, because obviously they understand the person already, and when they present with something that's in contact context with everything else that's happened. And I guess it's probably a similar thing. You know, is this a mother to be that's very anxious? Are they someone that has high thresholds or low thresholds for thing? And then you get this intuition based on knowing them, don't you? And it does just help. I mean, I'm not really used to that because obviously in A&E, actually, to be fair, we do see people back, obviously, but we're kind of always taking a little snapshot look at things. But that's it is really hard to do. You know, it does make it very difficult when you haven't met someone before. You really are just trying to make your best call in that moment. And that's got its downsides, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. And also, I mean, even in maternity services, we have like our own triage because we have like maternity A&E sort of vibe, you know, of people that need to be seen urgently. And so, yeah, in that sort of work, you are just doing that snapshot and you wouldn't expect your continuity midwife to come on just for that one, necessarily that one event. But and that's kind of what I guess the infertile midwife is about, is like being a midwife and a patient and actually having that relationship with someone. And again, this is one of the things that I speak about kind of in my book as well, is having that relationship with my fertility doctor. So I've been to a few IVF clinics and my first clinic was very much a conveyor belt. I would never see the same person twice. And when I switched to a different clinic, I made sure that my consultant did every single thing. He did every scan, every egg collection, every transfer. I saw him more than my husband, I think. So I would see him several times a week, you know, scans, bloods, the whole lot. And having that relationship is so important in healthcare, and it makes such a difference to how you feel and how you interpret your care, I think, as well. Like, you feel cared for.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Absolutely. It sounds like the whole system is, I mean, it's underfunded, like a lot of areas. But, you know, we do need to make sure that the funding, the resources are there available. We've got enough midwives that we can actually provide that continuity of care, because it makes a difference, doesn't it? And like, because that's what we were saying earlier on, that actually, you know, of course, you know, people can choose not to have children, but for the human race, by definition, it's a big part of it is having new generations coming through. We should have a service that doesn't just like meet the bare minimum, but hopefully aims for the best, right? The best care that you can possibly give. So just going back to where we started, so it's specifically thinking around things like baby loss and, you know, people going through difficult experiences during pregnancy, how can we make that kind of support better? Do we need standalone services? Do we need to have specialist services for, you know, baby loss and so on? Or, you know, what kind of needs to change specifically in that space?
So again, that's a real postcode lottery, but there are some really fantastic bereavement services. So where I work currently, the bereavement services are phenomenal and the care is incredible. And if you were pregnant again following a loss, you would have like so much extra support. And I feel really lucky actually to work. I don't work directly in that team. That would be a bit too close to the bone for me. But I feel really fortunate that the people that I work with are so invested in that service. Whereas if I think back to my previous trust, there's definitely gaps in that service of the provision for women who have experienced loss and then are subsequently pregnant. So yeah, my current trust, it's just a fantastic example. But again, like we've discussed kind of all afternoon, is that it's such a postcode lottery and it really depends on what your service providers are interested in investing their money in. And it's such a shame that it all comes down to money when actually like lived experiences. So, and you're doing public health masters, aren't you? So I wanted to pick your brain about this, I guess. But like pregnancy and postpartum are actually hugely influential in public health going forward. Yeah. So things like breastfeeding and stuff like that. And actually, why are we not really investing in those times, which can have such a positive...
Well, actually, even if you look at, life outcomes, it's not just actually your early years and your 0 to 5 that has a huge impact. It's your pre-early years. It's your
conception,
what was the pregnancy?
Care, yeah.
What was the family experience around conception, pregnancy, early childhood? Because traumas and things that happen around the family or poor maternal experience around that actually affects not just the mother, but then the child's life is affected. You think about how things like anxiety passed on through generations and things. And there's so much work now going, well, actually, it's not actually even just the 0 to 5, it's the minus. Then 0, then the 5 that has a huge, you know, impact on the whole of, you know, that person's life and, you know, the experiences that they will have. Of course, also you look at, you know, children, say, who are, you know, say 2 or 3 years old, and then the mother has another baby. What is that experience like? And what was the experience of the child in that setting? Do you know what I mean? So it's such a huge area. And you know, as I'm listening and I'm kind of thinking with the public. I mean, my area is public mental health that I'm doing, but we did a lot of foundation stuff in public health. You know, a lot of the things we think about is like equality and equity as well, like that kind of idea that we need to make sure that it's fair across the board, but also that we are supporting communities or people that are disproportionately affected. So we've got to think about like what people need even more help and are we helping them? But it feels like we're not even meeting equality, basic fairness across the board doesn't feel like we're going there. So I mean, when I'm listening and I kind of review what you said, it's kind of like even the IVF space, it should genuinely be fair. It should genuinely be a fair service. And if you're going to have support for one service, you know, in terms of baby loss or support in terms of one network, it should be the same across the board at minimum. Then you try and go even further for people that are disproportionately disadvantaged, isn't it?
Well, we know that like if you're from like a BAME community, it takes longer to access fertility services and you're less likely to be successful. And actually a similar theme throughout maternity services as well. We know that like ethnic minorities are disproportionately affected by adverse outcomes and things like that.
And I think a lot of the times people don't realise the levels of barriers to access of treatment. It's not just about barriers in terms of economic access to things. There's so many other like physical barriers that can be there, educational, informational barriers that can be there, as well as like, you know, things that can experience like discrimination and so on. There's so many things that can actually be in the way of someone actually getting what they should. And that's why that equity point is important. It's like, are we helping the people that need help more? And that's really important. That's what we should aim for with a health service, right? But you know, it just sounds like we need to even get to the equality bit first. There's one question I'd like to ask, and it's not an easy way of asking, but you've been through so much and my heart has literally gone to you, like with a lot of things that you shared. I'm certain everyone listening will feel the same. Do you feel like in the end, like everything you've been through, you know, you've got this beautiful 2-year-old, is it like, yes, I'm glad I went through all that. You know, the stuff that's happened that you just wish would never, ever happen, but you've been through all that. Like, how do you reflect on it all? How do you sit with it, you know?
It's such a good question. And I feel like a lot of kind of the narrative that, because as a society, we're driven to be like silver linings focused. So like, oh, you went through IVF, but look, you have your wonderful child. And I would say that there is nothing that is going to be worth my Cecil and Wilfred, my son's dying, because that means I'm comparing Percy to them or saying that he's better than them, and no parent is ever going to make that choice between their children. And so in that respect, you can't think that way. But obviously, if I hadn't gone through everything I've been through, I wouldn't have Percy, I wouldn't have, you know, an amazing community around me. I wouldn't have loads of empathy that I didn't have before. And I wouldn't have found my voice, because I really feel like Cecil and Wilfred, I like to think that their gift to me is that I found my voice. And so I wouldn't have that if they were here. But at the same time, I would give anything for them to be here. And when you have children that have died, your life is forever changed, and there's nothing, and you could spend your whole life just wishing that they were here, and there's nothing that's going to change that or make them be here. And so I don't really like to dwell on that. But I think the question of worth is really interesting, because what does worth mean? Like financially, yeah, I would spend millions of pounds having children, because that the worth is incomparable, because like a human, you can't put a price on my son, he's amazing. So in terms of like that sense of worth,
priceless,
then yes,
literally.
Like he is literally priceless. No, well, I will be reminding him when he's older of how much I invested in him. But, you know, that sort of worth is fine. But like, it's such a good question because emotionally, what I went through, I did get through it. It's such an interesting question because it means what do you think of worth? And I don't have the answer, but I'm in a good place, I think.
Do you know what? We've had so many conversations in the Slumpcast, ones that have actually been some really difficult conversations, but you've articulated that better, I think, than I've experienced in any other conversation I've had. The way, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but like the way you've managed to surmise something that must be so difficult to grapple is just it's so incredible. And yeah, I mean, yeah, how can something be worth something? How can you just, it's like one life to another, but I guess it's how you reconcile with it and the meaning you derive from it. And it sounds like, yeah, you're helping people, and it's difficult. I mean, again, I, it's very hard because you don't ever want to compare, but I can only compare my experience. But it's like people saying, like, would you change the past? I mean, would I go back and change what's happened? Of course, I'd love my brother to be alive. But then how many people, I literally had a message yesterday from someone, you know, shared with the group anonymously with my team, with someone saying that the story had saved their life. So how, the domino effect, you know, that kind of stuff. You change one thing and you change everything. But that's very difficult because selfishly, of course, I would go back and change it. But then would I? But anyway, yeah. Phenomenal. I think you're such an inspirational, and yeah, thank you for putting your words down in writing as well. I think I'm pretty certain everyone will have gone to order it, and they should. Shall we do our health fact of the week to wrap up, and then I can let you go because you've been very generous with your time. So this week's health fact of the week: fertility struggles affect a lot more people than you might think. So approximately 1 in 6 people or couples face difficulties conceiving naturally. Therefore, there is a chance you'll know someone going through it. It's also important to note here that there is a lot of focus on women's infertility issues, especially with the stigma and language, but it's estimated that up to 7% of men are affected by infertility, and 50% of fertility problems within a heterosexual couple are due to the man. Because there is a lot of language where people often automatically assume that say it's the woman, it's almost put at the woman's door. What are your thoughts on that, just initial reactions to that?
I think that you're absolutely right. There is such a big assumption that it's female factor infertility. And I think perhaps women, and again, generalisations, but like tend to talk more about that sort of thing. Whereas with men, and we sort of spoke about this previously, is it's also linked to, and similarly to like how I felt my fertility was linked to my sense of self-worth, I think men experience the same. And so being virile, being like a fertile man, is linked to your sense of self. And so it's definitely spoken about a lot less if you're a man, because how do you start that conversation of saying, you know?
So you think the stigma part actually is blocking some of that, the awareness, because people don't want to not admit it to be true, but they kind of don't want to talk about it?
Well, like, interestingly, even though with my husband and I, even though the infertility was my issue, my husband still felt like that he couldn't get me pregnant, which is like a horrible term of phrase, but like he still felt that there was some sort of failure on his part, even though it was not his fault at all. It really messes with your head when you're like experiencing infertility.
Yeah, I wonder if there's some work to be done there around that education point and like talking about it with men, because also almost by proxy, that will also remove some of the pressure from women's stuff. Because at the moment, we're going, okay, that's a woman's issue, because we're afraid to talk about it. If we actually talk about it amongst men or raise awareness, then it also goes, actually, this isn't the true picture here, but also, like, it's okay, like, you know, we can, you know, try and support men, but, you know, doesn't have to be the level of shame that perhaps it feels like there is with it, you know, because otherwise we're hiding it, but actually then making it all about women.
Yeah.
Which isn't fair either.
No, well, unfortunately, though, yeah. Even if you do have male factor infertility, the IVF is for the woman. The woman is the one that has to deal with the injections and the egg collections and things like that. So there is always going to be a level of kind of imbalance with that, because that's just how babies are made. So there is like an unfair onus on the women, I think.
Well, there's lots of work to be done, but having people like yourself that are advocating and literally on the ground, you know, supporting people, but also with your platform and stuff, is fantastic. So thank you so much for joining me on the Stompcast and things, and obviously the best of luck with the pregnancy and things as well.
Thank you very much.
You know, of course, everyone go and check out the book. We'll leave a link in the bio and also Instagram handle. And I know we've talked about some difficult topics here, you know, some things that might be triggering, you know, and certainly things that can be very upsetting. So please do check out, you know, if you go onto the show notes, look on the actual episode you're listening to, you can find the show notes there, and you'll find links, but also you know, we put in there the names of some of the charities that are mentioned, so you can access that support. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We will be doing a Behind the Stompcast reaction to the episode between me and Charlie. Afterwards, you can get that on Apple Podcasts if you head over and have a listen. Other than that, all I'll say is thank you so much for joining us, as always. We'll see you in another Stomp very soon. Take care and goodbye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.